All right, well, welcome to the last chapter of over 1,000 pages of reading and 4 months of survey. And I hope that you have gotten a flavor for the significance of Calvin. You may not regard yourself as a Calvinist. You may even have considerations of wariness in regards to him doctrinally, but the thing I think that you must be impressed by this time is the significance, the contribution, the complete upheaval of culture that Calvin and his writing have produced. And as we come to this last chapter, which we're going to have to really scurry through today, the thing that I want you to understand, the thing that should be obvious to you is, what is limited to just one chapter in this entire volume is also one of the most significant effects of Calvinism in the world. When you hear theologians and historians tip their hats to Calvin's institutes, it's for a variety of reasons. One is regarding his approach, his conclusions, his observations about the relationship of the church and state. Those not only revolutionized history, but they continue to be of debate today as well. And so even though it is just the one chapter at the very end, and it's hard to know exactly what Calvin's own thinking was when he was writing this, much of what comes up in this edition, and I'll mention this a little later, is in the very earliest of entries, 1536, very first volume, we remember, was only 6 chapters long. This was one of the chapters that was in it. And that he wrote this when he was 26 years old. And who in his right mind can think through such things when he's only 26 years old? And yet Calvin made this amazing contribution. Even then, he probably, I wonder how realistically he felt his words could be applied. It could very well be that, you know, he's writing in that white tower that he always wanted to be in, away from the riffraff, you know, and able to write in a theoretical term. How much he, you know, actually realized or thought this might become relevant in the real world, or whether he was just simply writing his philosophy of government and his philosophy of relationship to church and state. But it literally has been a powder keg in terms of its influence on culture going forward. So we are only able this morning to grossly underestimate the significance that he will bring to us. The title of the book, you remember, which covers the whole of the doctrine of the church, still applies in this today, and that is that he calls it the external means or aids by which God invites us into the society of Christ and holds us therein. And so we come to the last chapter, and it has these headings in it. The first is the general discourse on the necessity, the dignity, and the use of civil government in opposition to the frantic proceedings of the Anabaptists. And here again, he pits himself against those that he thinks bring much more discredit to the Word of God and to the integrity of the church, and wants to dismiss their fanaticism. They are primarily, in our minds, railing against the Roman Catholic Church. They don't want anything to do with the Roman Catholic Church. But the Anabaptists also include sects who are against the civil government and see it as part and parcel to the Roman Catholic Church as the problem, and they want to get rid of it all. And so he is stating that such radical flooding of the streets to wash them attitude is not proper and goes way too far. And so he is stressing something that they are not doing. And that is, you know, he says we must uphold the dignity of civil government. Civil government, he says, is not just an oppression of the poor. It is not just a scramble for the powerful. It is a legitimate exercise and a gift from God. That's what the scriptures say. There is a dignity and a use for civil government. There is a necessity to it. And all of that is being attacked and destroyed by the various Anabaptists who are going on. Now, the context of this, as I've mentioned, is important for you to realize. Of course, the Reformation is bringing a breakup of the Holy Roman Empire and a rise to the new concept of nationalism. And as that is going on, then of course the considerations of government in locales and in regions is being discovered and rewritten for all intents and purposes. And so most of the chapter that is written in the original, the 1536 edition, is done in the contexts of the Anabaptist revolt in Munster. Long story short, a couple of Anabaptists led a revolt in a particular town, overthrowing the civil government, making themselves the government, and ruled with an iron fist until they in turn were toppled and order was restored. And so that's going on. They ruled for 1 year before giving up the ship. And also Machiavelli's authoring of The Prince, which is kind of a, well, if you've never heard of it or read of it, it's kind of a theory on political government, how political government works. And he is already throwing aside or throwing out the biblical ethics that are involved. And he is laying out the various ways in which politicians may rise to power through corruption, through deceit, through economics, through the use of the military. It's amazingly candid and comprehensive, and has risen to the term today that we hear of sometimes in politicians' language today. When you ever hear the term Machiavellian, that comes from this guy, and it's the idea that, well, his politics are a little bit Machiavellian. What he means is that his politics are dirty, corrupt, sinister, and underhanded. And of course, you should always be asking yourself, how black is the pot calling the kettle? Because that's just another attack that politicians like to use against one another. That was written in 1531, published in 1532, becomes very popular, and is seen as a very educational piece. But that's in the context. So you've got the one that says civil government should be destroyed, anything but us, in a religious sort of way. God has put us in charge. That's the Anabaptists. The secular side of that is that we should throw ethics out. Ethics and accountability to God has nothing to do with government. You should lie, cheat, and steal. You should do whatever it takes to get whatever it is, power you want. And so that's the context. And to understand more about how Calvin's approach to all of this in dialogue with those contextual issues, you could also check his commentaries on Daniel and Romans. The second section is an exposition on the parts of the leading parts of the government of which civil government may indeed consist. Calvin is not stressing a particular style of civil government, but he is expressing a theory of government which would apply to any particular form of government and makes all the difference in the world, and we'll get to that. Okay, so the first thing he does is Calvin talks about a twofold governmental system. And what Calvin has in mind is simply this, that there is to be a civil government. He refers to Romans 13 and 1 Peter 3 and the various places where government is not only tolerated but even encouraged. Christians are to respect government, obey your government, take taxes to your government, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And he says there is a legitimacy to civil government, period, and that is to be seen by Christians as a blessing from God, not a curse. So right there is something that is, again, very radical. You know, even today, you know, Christians, like just like everybody else, likes to chew on their leaders and argue with their leaders in spite of what the scriptures say. What does the scripture say? Pray for them. You know, you got to be kidding. I don't even like this guy. Da-da-da-da-da. You know, but it's, you know, so Calvin is doing the radical thing. He's saying, come back to the Word of God. You are not to rail against the civil government. You're to pray for them. And you are, even more than that, you are to see the civil government as a positive blessing from God. Well, that goes down sideways, doesn't it? You know, one of the favorite things we like to do is complain about our government. So, you know, he's not speaking to the government. He's speaking to you. Your attitude, your words. This convicts me deeply because I'm right up there. There's no politician which is good enough for me, you know, that kind of deal. And so he's directing persons with regard to social responsibility and leading to civil justice and outward morality. That's the work of the civil government, is social justice and outward morality. Now, you know, what do you hear today from one major political party today than the other, but also from the not independents, what am I thinking of? Libertarians, who tell you it's not the government's job to legislate morality. You ever hear that? It's not the government's job to legislate morality. And of course, what they mean by that is anything I don't like is immoral. Everything I don't want should not be legislated against me, but everything I do want is morally right, and therefore the government should do that. You hear that all the time, right? You know, and the idea is morality is used as language to toss back and forth. But Calvin is saying, no, it is the government's job to legislate morality and enforce morality, but of course based on what? Is it to be based on personal opinion? Is it to be based on cultural mores? No, it's to be based on the Ten Commandments. It's to be based on the Word of God. That's the basic principle. And it's their job to protect outward, call for outward morality, which is, you know, in the simplest form, would just simply say enforce the golden rule. Do unto others what you would have them do unto you. That's outward morality. But even today, you know, we don't see that. We don't see golden rule being pushed or pressed by the government. We see twists and turns in all kinds of different directions. So he says the first one regards our attitude towards the government has to change, and then we have to appreciate them as a positive blessing and know that their job is to promote civil justice and outward morality. And then the church's job, the spiritual, the ecclesiastical, the church's job is to work on the heart, is to deal with the conscience and the conviction that will require and call you to repentance and faith and hope for glory. Now that is a very important aspect to the church's authority to do, because we're not dealing just with outward conformity. We're dealing with the preparation of the heart, not just so that Christians are good law-obeying citizens, but that even if they are under a sinful and wicked political government, what are they doing? They are hoping, looking for, pressing for the glory to come. The faith in them must be the outstanding principle in their lives. Now, what does that mean by implication? Calvin's going to be the last one to call for revolution. Social upheaval and revolution that overthrows and destroys a government, you know, that is in place. He's not going to say there's not a place for it, but he's not going to press for it. Because this world is not the end for the Christian. And so this is an eschatological view. You know, he's pressing Christians, say, whatever you are under, you are called first and foremost to endure, to strengthen your hope for what is to come. Very important point. And he says these two kingdoms, he refers to them as kingdoms, the civil kingdom, the spiritual kingdom, are separate and distinct in jurisdiction and authority. Now this is radical for the culture of the time, because the government was definitely in control of what the church did. And you remember the first 2 years in Geneva, Calvin wanted to bring ecclesiastical authority into the exercise of church discipline. The civil government wanted to maintain authority over the church and said, you have to come to us. And so when that clash hit, they kicked him out of the town. And when he came back by their invitation, he eventually was able to persuade them of the separation of church and state in that regard. And so this is where he's coming from, even from the very first edition. This is where he's coming from. They should have, the city council should have read the Institutes when he first came. And so even if Calvin was nothing but a young hotshot wanting his way all the time, even if he was the most belligerent person in the world, all they had to do was read his stuff to know where he was coming from and what he was about. It wasn't like he was trying to make unpopular waves all the time. Now, I want just an aside about this notion of two kingdoms that Calvin brings out is also in dialogue with, and that's a safe word to use, dialogue with Luther's writings on the relationship of church and state. Luther's perspective on this was used the same language. He was also two kingdom. But Luther, you remember, Luther was not he didn't have a long-term view of this. And so just like other things only left the Roman Catholic Church as far as they needed to, like transubstantiation became consubstantiation, that's fine. The music in the church only came so far, the regulative principle only got so far. Before Luther would say, that's fine, we don't need to do any more radical than this. He was also the same way with his relationship to the church and state. He didn't see anything wrong with the council running the affairs of the church, as it always had been. He said, that's fine. Let the council determine those things. I'm too busy preaching anyway. I'm too busy teaching. I don't want to be handling disciplinary matters. Luther was, very accepting of that kind of relationship. And that led to something that is called Erastianism. Erastianism comes from the person Erastus, who defines and works the theory. And it's the idea that the church belongs under the state's authority. And so Erastianism was very, very popular and very much of the mindset in England when the Anglican Church became in power under Henry VIII. That view stayed the same. So Luther uses the same language, two kingdoms, but he's saying, I don't have any problem with the civil government exercising authority in the church. Calvin's more long-range, more long-reaching, and he says, no, it's definitely something that needs to be separated so that the exercise of spiritual authority is something that is real, and that separates the two, the state has no business telling the church what is scriptural and what is morally ethical and what the church should do. Yeah.
Instead of a rabbit hole, but what
Yes, he did. Very perceptive of you. Yes. Augustine, of course, lived in the 4th century under the Roman Empire. And Constantine not only legalized Christianity, made it the official religion of the state, and he himself as the head of the church. And so Augustine went along with that. You could say that Luther took his cue from Augustine. Augustine did not call for a revolution against the state in order for the church, because there was only the one church. It was the Roman Empire. It was the church of the king. And he did not see a separation. But he still referred to it as two kingdoms also, just like Luther. So Luther took one tack. Calvin went another way. I can only go so far with this, so I'm just going to touch base on it. You will hear, if you're perceptive, if you're reading blogs, if you're online on this, you might hear even today of the debate in Reform circles about the two-kingdom view. And they will say they credit Calvin for starting this. That right now I see much less to do with Calvin in the Reformed push for this than I do in a similarity. One of the areas that I regard as most suspect has to do with what is under the first point there with Lutheranism, which says God rules over the worldly kingdom by way of laws. It is the state's job to legislate morality. It is the state's job to execute social justice. It is a state's job to control outward behavior, those kinds of things, based on the Ten Commandments. That's one thing. But then that leaves the other kingdom, the heavenly kingdom, to exercise its authority by the gospel and by grace. And the reason that trips me up is because I think it smacks of antinomianism in the church. That there is no law, there is no Ten Commandments that should be read in the worship of God. That Christians themselves should not be held accountable to the law of God, but only the grace of God. And that antinomianism is a real issue in my mind. And when I hear of the two-kingdom view going on today in Reformed debate, my suspicion, at least, is that that's what's going on. And you see that in some evangelical churches today who want to throw out the Ten Commandments. There's no law to worry about. Of course, there's 19th century dispensationalism, you know, rejected the entire Old Testament. And we see carryover of that today in some circles where, you know, the idea is that we just need to focus on the grace and the joy of God and not worry about what He calls you to do. Because that's a civil matter, and they say, and this is not. And it's just not so. You cannot have the gospel without the law. And so that probably opens up a can of worms I can't go into. So we'll move on from there. Forget that. Okay, the civil government, he says, is necessary. And he would say that civil government began being necessary with the fall. It wasn't necessary before the fall. There was no reason to enforce man's outward behavior before that. But since the fall, civil government is necessary. The fact of sin in the world requires civil government. And of course, that itself is a world and life view. Yeah, you understand that. I mean, it probably just rolls right off your tongue when you say that because you're a Christian and you're used to it. But you have to understand that that is what's evaporating very fast in our world today. Is the concept of sin in man. When that worldview is done, then that changes the whole perspective on what the church is for, what the government's for, and who it is that's actually in charge. So the fact of sin must be well embraced and understood and believed in order to justify civil government. That's an important aspect of that. This would be the reason that Munster took off the way it did, was because they would have denied this and said, you know, we may run our own thing because we're led by the Spirit. There is no sin. And so that's an issue. Civil government, he says, is a provision of God's goodness rather than seeing it as a polluted thing to be rejected. And again, that, you know, it's just that whole concept of how the what the Christian is charged to submit to emotionally, intellectually, in every way, that civil government, without definition yet, is something you are called to submit to as a Christian. And not to be something, not seeing it as something that is only polluted and needing to be thrown out. He says civil government is the preservation and blessing of humanity against those of his day who were saying that that it should be, it is the curse of humanity. No, it's sin that is the curse of humanity. And he's saying that otherwise, if you reject civil government like many of them wanted to do in that day, that it will not lead to a utopia, will not lead to a blessing, you know, a wonderful world of peace, love, and no problem. But it will lead to anarchy, and anarchy always leads to tyranny. Remember that. Anarchy always leads to tyranny. And so it's the cycle that starts all over. You overthrow the king, the government's in turmoil until what? The next king comes up. Somebody else comes and takes his place. It doesn't have to be that way, Calvin is saying. You know, sociologists would say that's the way it always works. It's just a cycle because that's the way man is. Calvin says, no, we do not have to let sin master us. We do not have to let sin rule us. We can change this. But it takes faith in God to do it. He says a civil magistrate, and he uses that term a lot, which is a very important term I want to define. A civil magistrate's different than the magistrate, the king. The king is the magistrate. The king is the one who, you know, in monarchies rules over all. The civil magistrate is the one who is appointed or elected or purchases his position of power as somebody under the king. And so civil magistrates make up the councils. Civil magistrates make up the governors. Civil magistrates make up the local governing bodies and authorities. So a civil magistrate, he says, is a calling from God just as a minister is. Being a civil magistrate is a calling from God, and therefore he is answerable to God. He needs to understand he is answerable to God in his own. He is under God's law himself. He's not above it. He's not above the law. That, of course, is the big thing about divine right of kings back in England's time, when Charles I and then Charles II were really stressing the divine right of kings. It is God who has put me on the throne. Who are you to talk back to me and to challenge me? That's not the same thing as this. Calling from God means the magistrate himself is under the law as well and must serve knowing that he answers to God. He's God's vice regent. He's the vicar. He's the deputy. And he is under divine authority, answerable to God for what he does. The civil magistrate is to enforce and encourage the obedience. The primary work of the civil magistrate, then, in carrying out his task of social justice and outward morality, he is to enforce and encourage obedience to the commands of the second table of the moral law. Remember I said, well, you know, if he's to enforce morality, whose morality will he enforce? The Ten Commandments. The first king, the worldly kingdom, the civil magistrate's job is to enforce the last six of the, or the second table of the law, the last six commandments, whereas the ecclesiastical is to enforce the first four. He is to promote the true Protestant religion. In other words, he is to support it. He is to say, yes, you belong in church and worship. You must not make idols. You must honor the Lord's Day. Those are outward compliances to the law that the civil magistrate would sense an authority to exercise. And it included preventing the opposition from forming against, preventing opposition from forming against the church, defending piety so that a public manifestation of religion may exist among Christians. So this, you know, and this is where the tension of Calvin's world is breaking apart all around him. Because, you know, on one hand, his what he inherited was a world of singularness. One government, one church, one religion, one faith. You know, we've made it two now. We've left the Roman Catholic Church, but we have denied them. They're heresy. They aren't real. So we are the true church. But his world is rapidly changing all around him into pluralism. Now we must accept everybody's different points of views. Now we have to, we can't just burn a heretic. We have to be more tolerant. And that is shaking up his theory. That doesn't fit for Calvin. Calvin did not have that concept in his mind. And so, you know, he's saying the government's job is to enforce outward behavior of Protestants in the process of obeying the moral law. Well, you know, then okay, comes along the church across the street, says, well, we don't believe that art forms of God are a problem. Well, then whose laws are we going to enforce? Who's, you know, creation of idols, not creation of idols? That pluralism is going to break apart the consistency of Calvin's viewpoint here. The civil magistrate is to protect the outward function of the church, as opposed to micromanaging its inner workings, such as discipline, such as barring of the table, such as recognizing and ordaining ministers, such as all of the other things that the church does on its own accord. Heresy, therefore, is an ecclesiastical and a civil crime. Here's where you get into both of these aspects come along with Servetus, who denied the Trinity, who denied predestination, who argued in many ways that were regarded by church and state as heretical. And so the state wound up executing Servetus in Geneva for heresy. You know, but again, pluralism is part of the reason why the whole business with Servetus left a bad mark on Calvin personally. Because now people look back on it, you know, and they say, well, my next door neighbor is a Unitarian. He doesn't believe in the Trinity. He's a nice guy. Why would I want to burn him? Why would Calvin want to burn somebody who just thinks differently than he does? You know, that's pretty oppressive. And, you know, so the pluralism is something that's not worked out completely in Calvin. And that's why it brought some problems later on. Because the state only has one religion, heresy, notice the spelling is awkward, is tantamount to treason before the magistrate. But Calvin insists that this is not a theocracy. This is not like a Mosaic administration. This is not like a Mosaic political structure of theocracy where the church enforces political endeavors. This is church and state are separate, but they are unified. That was key to Calvin. They see things the same way. They believe the same things. They want to acknowledge God and his law, and they want to enforce their laws according to God and his law. And because they see the same things, that the civil magistrate acts, the church is in unison with it. It doesn't take opposition. And then lastly, the civil magistrate has the task of waging war. And this also is very significant. This is Western civilization, historically, at its best, and in a very profound way. Calvin says that war may be justified. There are times when the civil government may properly engage in war. But it must be for a purpose, a social civil reason, and not just for a land grab, not just for greed, not just for racial hatred, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. War is not only an extreme necessity, it may be exercised, but not out of blind or raging hatred, even war, must be done for a just reason. And because it is done with a just reason, there should be a, and he admits it, this is a real hard line to follow, there should be a theoretical line between what is appropriate and what is not. So he said there should not be just implacable severity, torturing the innocents to destroy the nation, he says, would be too far, would not be appropriate. Now he admits, Calvin admits, this is a line you simply can't enforce. It's very, very hard to have umpires in war, you know, blowing their whistle like in an NFL game, saying, okay, offsides, 15 yards. But what will go into war that will make the significant difference? That Christian world and life view. If life means something, if man is in the image of God, if there is a commandment not to kill, not to murder maliciously, to slaughter, then even in war, when I am forced to do what I must do for justifiable reasons, there should be a curb on my savagery and my brutality. And my friends, that is the difference historically in Western civilization and in every other civilization. And I without getting too engrossed into the topic, I think that the Lord has honored his word when we see the Western civilization winning again and again and again and again and again in times of conflict. And why the evaporation of that Christian world and life view is going to bring us into more and more and more of a savage kind of warfare than we've ever seen before in Western countries is coming. And so, but this is another significant place where Calvin's influence is just very powerful. We're continuing with the civil magistrate. Calvin does not strictly advocate one form of government over another. So here he says he's not saying, okay, a government's got, he did not try to design governmental theory, but he did lay out the basic principles based on that world and life view, that biblical understanding of man that has to be there. So he doesn't strictly advocate one civil government over another, and yet, at the same time, he says this. He does propose a system that is constituted of an aristocracy, and he would use the word meritorious, in other words, those who have earned the reputation for credibility and for wisdom, and not just those who inherit it. He's using a word that we even hear regarding aliens coming across the border today, meritorious, proving their merit. It should be a system of compounded of a meritorious aristocracy, and as well as a democracy, those elected from the public and among the citizenry. He says that combination is necessary because he says pure democracy. This is also very profound. Pure democracy leads to anarchy. Democracy, in the by definition, is simply the tyranny of the majority over the minority, and that, in other words, it's the biggest dog in the room who gets their way. And I want you to remember that Calvinistic principle when you hear people talk about why we democracy is the best thing to do, and democracy, and they do not know what they're talking about because they do not have a Christian world and life view that says man is not to be trusted. And that a democracy will tyrannize the minority and will rule over it and will silence it if they can. We saw a very good illustration of this in the construction of the process by which presidents are elected in this country. We have something called an electoral college. What is an electoral college? It simply says every state will be adequately represented. The areas where the most compact or concentrated populations who might generate a majority will not rule over other sections which will then not be represented at all. That is the principle behind the Electoral College, is that the nation shall be represented in a balanced fashion. And that's why sometimes there are elections that put us in great consternation, because one side will win the majority vote and the other side will win the Electoral College vote. And I'd say, why don't we let the majority win? Well, democracy is not to be trusted. If there was no sin in the world, democracy would make sense, because the majority would care for the minority. But in a sinful world, that will not be the case. And so that's just another point there. But Calvin saw it. That's what I'm saying. This is Calvinism in its Calvinistic theory here. And this you can see we're still dealing with that today. So remember that when your politicians are saying we need to throw out this antiquated old system of the Electoral College. We need to let the majority call their own, and let the majority speak. You are asking for this very thing that Calvin warned us about. He says the government should be ruled by a plurality of leaders, because there is safety in numbers, and that is better than a monarchy, especially a monarchy who inherits his throne to provide checks and balances because of man's faults and failings. So, it's this structure of governmental authority that's the Christian world and life view that our founding fathers had in mind. Whether they themselves were Christians or not is beside the point. They came to it with a Christian world and life view. They were steeped in Calvinism, and they understood what he was saying. Yes, we need checks and balances. Yes, we need more than one house of congressmen. Yes, we need a balanced form of power sharing, because man is not to be trusted. Man is not to be trusted. So that's a big point. No kind of government is more happy than one where freedom is regulated with becoming moderation and is properly established on a durable basis. Becoming, that's complementary moderation. A becoming moderation. When politicians are not moderate in their tone of voice, in their criticism of those across the aisle, of the character assassination that takes place so regularly today, they are not being moderate in their tone. They're not becoming in their moderation. And it is to be properly established on a durable basis. That's the closest that Calvin can come to saying something as foundational as the Ten Commandments. Durable means something that will withstand, not something that never ever needs to be changed, but something that can withstand the storms, withstand the challenges, withstand the attacks. Not be something that will be found to have holes that will be eaten away slowly. The foundation must be solid. It must be able to stand firm. Okay? The concept of that durable foundation is very important. The magistrate must be careful not to dishonor and disregard proper use of civil authority. So it is the magistrate's job to remember he answers to God. And in this regard, he is to avoid the cruelest gentleness. Cruelest. What? Give me an example of that. What would he mean by the cruelest gentleness? Yeah, in a way. Give me a specific example of what it means to be cruelly gentle.
Perhaps to lightly punish really violent crimes like rape or murder.
Lightly punish, okay, lightly punish violent crimes. Be overly or excessively forgiving in the case of violent crimes. Yeah, okay. Anyone else? I'm going to show my cards here, okay? I think that when the Bible specifically and clearly calls for capital punishment, and we decide that no, we're not going to kill this man, even though he murdered and is convicted of murdering 10 people, we're going to commit him to lifetime in prison, where he can become a mentor to somebody else, and maybe many others who are going to be released from prison and sent out. And the prison system can then expand and cover the nation and become a business in itself that is so much of a tax burden on the people of God, on the people in the nation, that it becomes oppressive. And before long, the people in the prison begin ruling the system. And now we are afraid of the monsters that we have created. I think that is a classic example of cruel gentleness. It's just I think that's exactly what Calvin would say too, you know. He must also not exercise too much power unlawfully. He must avoid excessive severity. What is that? What would be an example of excessive severity? Well, yeah. A long sentence for a minor crime. Torture. What jumps to my mind first and foremost when I think about this is how litigious we've allowed our culture to be. Where you can sue somebody for a very insignificant thing, for spilling your hot McDonald's coffee on your own lap. And then manipulating the exercise of personal freedom with the threat of lawsuit. To take somebody to court just to simply drive them into poverty. To manipulate the system politically through the court system. I think that's another good example of what it means to be excessively severe. The magistrate also then has the right to make its own laws. The magistrate should be able to establish its own laws. Such laws, however, he says, must be in conformity to the rule of justice, mercy, and love, which is, in other words, the foundation of the Bible, the Word of God, laws cannot be passed that are counter to that Christian world and life view. Such laws need not create the political system of Moses. He says we're not after a theocracy again. We don't have to, completely duplicate everything that was in the legislative laws of Moses. But we definitely use that as a pattern. We definitely use that to understand how the Bible would have us regard ourselves in our own culture. So the magistrate has a right to make its own laws and to levy taxes upon the people, but not out of tyrannical extortion. Who's going to define that? Who's going to define that when your governor says we need to tax the rain? Who's going to define what is tyrannical extortion and who is not? Based on what? Why trust the people? Again, it's not something simple. It's not something, laid out. It's the worldview. It's the worldview of someone saturated with the mind of God. But when so many people reject the world and life view of Christ, when so many people would not be caught dead in church, would have never read the Bible, don't want anything to do with Christianity, want to make our own way, then there is, again, the Bible tells us there is no one we may depend on. Man is not trustworthy. That's the fundamental rule. Man is not trustworthy. So when he says we need to reject the Bible, we need to go our own way, believe me, I know what I'm doing. He's the one we must not trust right off the bat. magistrate makes its own laws, that levies taxes, allows for rightly exercised lawsuits, and Calvin says, following the golden rule. He warns against your society becoming litigious for manipulative reasons. He says, don't allow that. Why would you do that? Because you hate the person. Not because there's justice involved, but because you hate the person. And you want to ruin the person. And you want to destroy the person. And he says, that is counter to the golden rule. He says, the golden rule should, that's a world in life view. The golden rule is not something that every nation and every civilization embraces. That is something uniquely Christ-given. And so the world in life view of the Bible has to be there. That's fundamental for Calvinism. He says, without that, we're lost. We've given ourselves to a man that is not trustworthy. So you've got the civil, did I do that already? Yeah, I think I did. Oh, yeah, the two kingdoms are separate and distinct in jurisdiction and in authority. The church, in other words, is not to assume what is proper to the magistrate, and nor can the magistrate execute what is to be carried out by the church. And then finally, there is to be this cooperation between the two. The church is to comply, obey, reverence, and esteem the magistrate, even if you don't like it. Even if you think that you are under the worst government that ever existed, your first obligation is to respect it. Because if Christians respect the government uniformly first, then that will affect the government. You know, the heartfelt tug of war that's going on even in our own nation today, you know. Do you like this guy? No. Do you like that guy? No. They're going back and forth. Christians are lured into, we're sucked into that. We're sucked into that business that taking sides is the most important expression of my Christian commitment. And Calvin says, no, taking sides is not the first and foremost position. Honoring the government, that durable foundation, is first. And regarding that, he says, why should we do that? Why should we esteem a governor that we can't stand? This kind of thing. Because first and foremost, and here again, nobody but a Christian is going to understand this. Sometimes Christians don't understand this. It teaches us patience. Anybody here want to learn patience? Come on, raise your hand. You want to learn patience. Come on. Nobody wants to learn patience. It teaches us patience. Why would we want to be patient? I want my government to act this way now. We're going to hell in a handbasket. Why should I? Because what? Because my hope is in heaven, not here. And so the influence I have is not revolutionary. The influence I'm to have now points others to Christ as well. It teaches us patience and, here's the other thing we don't want to hear, to consider our own sinfulness. No, he's a jerk. He's a cad. She should be thrown out. It's all his fault. It's all her fault. We are to consider our own sinfulness first. Who's throwing all the stones? So he says there is a moral lesson that keeps the Christian on the right path. It's not laws. It's not outward compliance. It's not whether your party wins or loses. The moral lesson is always to be learned by you. Your party won. Praise God. You should humbly come to the Lord with satisfaction and thanksgiving. Your party lost. You should pray that God would make you, that would temper your attitude and would strengthen you for the days in which you may have to stand for Christ and be persecuted, and regard that as a good thing. Unjust rulers, he says, are raised up by God just like just rulers are, because of our sin and our move to move us to implore, to ask God for help. The church is to be on her knees. How often is the church on her knees when your political party wins? No, you're not on your knees. You're dancing in the streets. It's when we feel the oppression. It's when we feel the attack. It's when all of the wonderful, precious material things of the United States are slipping through our fingers, and there ought to be a law, and what's wrong with those idiots? And, you know, we get angry, we get frustrated, we get bitter, but we don't get humble. Calvin says we are to be humbling ourselves in times like that. But he does say the church is to comply as far as is possible. He never prescribes a program for revolution, although his disciple John Knox thought that that was appropriate. He will go a little bit farther in this regard than Calvin does. And Calvinists, looking back historically, do say that Calvin may be leaning on the pacifist side a little too much. But Knox is maybe the more consistent in this regard. I don't know. We'll stay tuned. But John Knox was prone to do that. Calvin would never call for a revolution. He says it is the responsibility and right of the lesser magistrates, that's the checks and balances aspect, in other words, to provide protection of the people against the misuses of the king by attempting to influence or change the government if necessary. It's up to those that are in power to call corruption when they see it and to make the change. Not just to get somebody out of power, but to call that the injustice needs to be addressed. And it's that sharing of power, Calvin says, that makes that possible. May not make it always doable. Politics may always and forever be in loggerheads and locked up in conflict and debate. But it's better that way, Calvin says, than it is to release the king to do whatever he wants to do. We are much better off in that situation. So the sum of our duty, Calvin says, is we must obey God rather than man. But in doing that, we are not to parade that for our own advantage. When we obey God, we must obey God. But we will obey God first by submitting to the government he's put into place, or he's allowed to put in place, rather than deny that it's needful or to seek to overthrow it. So again, it's a heartfelt issue that's going on, and it's a very important aspect. Our goal is not selfishness. Our goal is not independence. Our goal is piety. You have a nation of people seeking to live holy lives. Then you have peace. Even in the midst of storm, you have peace. But when you don't have that, when you don't have a nation seeking to live holy lives but reveling in unholiness, then even in times of peace, you have nothing but torment. You have nothing but torture. You have nothing but persecution. You have nothing but tyranny. Calvin sees all this. Nothing's changed. Okay, any questions about any of that? Any comments? Yeah, Jonathan. I don't know. Did Geneva have a constitution? Geneva in Calvin's time had a very complex system of governance. As regarding a written constitution, I don't know, but they had the first level of governance, which was a large council. Then they had a small council above them, and then a smaller council above them. And everything kind of had to go upstairs. Calvin was turning Geneva upside down itself in terms of how they ran things. But I don't recall anything about a written constitution. I'm sure there were probably bylaws or some kind of structure. Anyone else? Okay, well, thank you. It has been a long haul, has it not? I will be off next week. And then after that, I want to begin on the study of